This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. From Amazon's package delivery drone to the Air Force's mighty MQ-1 Predator, unmanned aerial vehicles come in a variety of shapes and sizes. Down at the coast, marine scientists are working on new ways to apply the technology with promising results. It all starts in a large open field in Beaufort. Assistant professor of the practice of marine conservation and ecology at the Duke Marine Lab, Dave Johnston, lugs a gray, hard-shell carrying case out into the middle of a clearing, sets it down, and begins assembling the battery-powered fixed-wing drone.
Made by a company called Sensefly. They're a Swiss company. They make both these kind of fixed-wing platforms, and they also make the multi-copters, the like quadcopter-type ones as well.
Weighing in at just over 24 ounces, the EB is no predator. Inside, it contains a GPS, barometer, and an instrument that measures wind speed called a pitot tube. Once Johnston attaches the wings, the drone prepares itself for takeoff.
The pitot tube has an LED in it, and right now it's going through all its system checks. And when it glows green, it'll have found all of its GPS locations, it'll have set its barometer and everything, and it's ready to go.
Once the EB finishes its autonomous pre-flight check, all Johnston has to do is program the flight plan on his laptop. While this is just a testing exercise, he hopes the Marine Lab will one day be able to use the EB for research projects, like mapping marshes and tracking sea turtles.
You can see on the map here that we're in this spot. What we'll do is we'll just make a little survey pattern, and you can see it's drawn a little box there, and we can then upload that to the drone.
Because the drone uses GPS for navigation, Johnston says it's very accurate.
It'll come and land. See, it's going through its flight tests right now, but it will come and land within probably 5 meters of the spot right here.
After the radio modem wirelessly transmits the flight information to the drone, we're ready to fly.
And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to shake it 3 times, and that's going to start up the propeller. And the propeller will then speed up and get to its appropriate RPMs for takeoff. Pilot probe will change colors. It'll go blue at first, and then it'll start flashing green when it's pretty much ready to go. And then if I tilt it up a little bit, it'll go back to solid green, and then it's ready for a launch. There it goes.
It's windy today, and the drone is tossed around as it climbs to an altitude of about 250 feet. Instead of a drone, it looks more like a hawk soaring high above the ground. But to Johnston, it resembles a fighter jet.
We kind of went with the Top Gun names. Right now, Maverick's in the air, and Iceman's back in the lab.
Both drones can stay in the air for up to an hour, but because of the winds today, Johnston decides to bring Maverick down. He enters the command to land into his laptop, and it's transmitted to the drone.
So now it's figured out that it's going to come back. It'll circle to figure out the best approach vector for landing, and then it's going to come back in and land, hopefully, kind of right where we thought it would.
As Maverick gradually descends, the propeller changes speeds rapidly, and the flaps adjust to bring it in for a soft landing.
Well, a little windy. Usually it comes back like within about 5 meters, but yeah.
It's not the best day for flying drones, but with each test, Johnston is gaining more experience and collecting valuable information on how the technology could help scientists study the coastal environment.
It makes our research, you know, more efficient and safer. We can sample kind of in between the scales that we normally have from satellites looking down versus walking around and making samples on the ground. This kind of fits right in the middle.
While satellites are only useful during the day, drones could be operated at night. Additionally, unmanned aerial systems are safer and more cost-effective than using airplanes or helicopters for research. Johnston says scientists who study storm surge and coastal erosion could use drones to survey the coastline more often and better document the changes.
Those people working on fisheries to be able to understand and map fish habitat, oyster beds and oyster reefs, effects of things like storms on them. There's a huge number of things that are being done at both IMS and CMAST at the NC State Lab that would benefit from this technology.
For now, Johnston and 3 other scientists involved with testing the drones must adhere to strict FAA guidelines, limiting flight below 400 feet and within visual line of sight. Johnston says the Duke Marine Lab applied for Section 333 exemption, which would allow them to fly drones in the National Airspace System.
The things that we're doing have all been previously exempted, the same aircraft, the same techniques,
we have a slightly different reason, research and education, but all those are very critical to making sure that unmanned aerial systems are incorporated properly and safely into the airspace. So we suspect that the FAA will be really happy to get our exemption, and that allows us to start doing things and provide them feedback on how it goes.
If the exemption is approved, Johnston says they'll begin work promptly on mapping marsh areas and tracking how they change with the seasons, and developing techniques for finding stranded animals along the shoreline.
I want to start working with sea turtles to be able to do at-sea surveys for sea turtles and looking for stranded turtles, working with NOAA and the state on those things. And then also really simple things like doing everyday flights here from the Marine Lab to be able to do a time series to look at change in the Bird Shoals area right across from the Marine Lab. A whole bunch of different things. Lots of opportunity.
Currently, Duke Marine Lab is involved in research using drones to document marine debris on beaches around the world through a project called Race for Water. Johnston hopes to apply the same technique to measure the impact plastic waste is having on beaches here in North Carolina. They also hope to monitor seal habitats and count their numbers from Cape Cod to Cape Hatteras later this year. The Duke Marine Lab should know by mid-July if their exemption is approved. In the meantime, an unmanned aerial systems workshop is planned at the coast June 29th through the 30th that will focus on marine science applications that employ drones and a participant-driven exploration of desires, expectations, and concerns about creating an unmanned aerial system in the community.
We've invited all of our science partners at all the science institutions in the region. We've also invited all the agencies, the federal and state agencies that deal with natural resource management, to come together and help us kind of scope out and guide the development of a drone facility at the Marine Lab, and something that we hope would, you know, form the backbone of a broader sort of development of that kind of capacity here in our region.
The two-day June workshop takes place at the Duke Marine Lab on Pivers Island in Beaufort from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. For more information, go to our website, publicradioeast.org, and click on the ENC events calendar. Jacksonville police are aggressively issuing citations to drivers who block major intersections during busy commuter periods along Lejeune Boulevard. Sarah Finch has more.
Motorists in Jacksonville are all too familiar with traffic congestion, especially around Camp Lejeune in the morning and afternoon. And the problem didn't get any better when the Marine Corps base closed one of their gates on May 27th. Camp Lejeune Public Affairs Director Nat Fay says they shut down the gate for security reasons and to free up military personnel to manage other base entrances.
The Tarawa Terrace gate has been closed permanently. We understand that this represents something of an inconvenience for people who live nearby that gate. What it has done is prompted people to use the Tarawa Terrace 2 gate.
And this is where navigating gets tricky. Traffic is bottlenecking at the intersection of Lejeune and Weston Boulevard as people turn left to enter the base at TT2 gate. Eager to get to their destination, motorists are squeezing through the intersection and blocking traffic even after the stoplight has turned red. This prohibits traffic flow on the eastbound lane of Lejeune Boulevard. The city responded initially by increasing the length of the green light. So far, City Transportation Services Administrator Anthony Prinz says it hasn't solved the issue.
From the city's traffic center, we're monitoring the situation daily. We've made the timing changes that we could make without impacting the entire corridor and without flooding the gate with vehicles causing blockages.
Prinz says the city can't make additional changes to those signals without causing further delays both upstream and downstream. In order to prevent accidents and eliminate congestion, Jacksonville police are stepping in. This week, they kicked off a new initiative to issue traffic citations for drivers who pull out into the middle of the intersection illegally. Lieutenant Sean McGill is Jacksonville Police Department's field operations supervisor.
Just because the light is green doesn't give you arbitrary right just to go into the intersection. You have to make sure you can go all the way through it.
According to North Carolina law, motorists can't enter an intersection unless there is sufficient space on the other side of the intersection to accommodate their vehicle without obstructing other vehicles. Which means, if you pull out into an intersection, make sure you can get across or you may get a ticket. Lieutenant McGill says police will monitor the busy intersection for the next 2 weeks or until they witness more voluntary compliance. So far, preliminary news releases in the area have worked well to warn people about these changes, and only 2 tickets have been written since June 8th. With the traffic fine and the court costs adding up to $205, it's a steep price to pay for a moment of haste. To alleviate congestion and avoid a costly citation, base commuters are being encouraged to use the new Wilson Gate.
The amount of time that you would wait to sit through 1 or 2 cycles trying to make the left turn to go into TT2 Gate, you would have more than enough time to actually drive about that 3/4 mile through the Wilson Gate and start working your way back where you're in the housing development.
Lieutenant McGill says the Wilson Boulevard Gate is open weekdays until 7 p.m. and is designed to handle more traffic with less impact on Lejeune Boulevard. For Public Radio East, I'm Sarah Finch.
The Arts Council of Wayne County, in partnership with the North Carolina Arts Council and Goldsboro Parks and Recreation, presents the Youth of the African American Music Trail concert on Friday, June 26th. The free concert highlights the talents of young African American musicians here in eastern North Carolina. Today, Mac McKee speaks with the executive director of the Arts Council, Sarah Merritt, about the event.
The African American Music Trails of North Carolina were established by the North Carolina Arts Council to celebrate the contributions of African American musicians and display the musical heritage of the region. Sarah, thanks for being with me. When did the idea for the African American Music Trails come about, and how did the Arts Council of Wayne County become involved with this project?
The North Carolina Arts Council conceived of the African American Music Trail project around 2005 or so, and in 2006 they began working on it in earnest. They decided that they were going to obviously focus on the eastern part of North Carolina because we have such a rich musical heritage in this part of the state. And then they even narrowed in on their focus a little bit more and decided to start with 8 counties for the trail. So the 8 counties are Wilson, Wayne, Edgecombe, Greene, Jones, Lenoir, Nash, and Pitt counties. So we're the original 8.
What are some of the sites in Wayne County where people can learn about some of the rich African American musical heritage?
Oh, that's a really great question. Well, I would say that one of the main sites is at the Arts Council of Wayne County. We have been very focused on the African American Music Trails project from the very beginning. We were fortunate enough to, in 2010, host a Smithsonian exhibit about American roots music, and that really got us involved and helped us to reach out and connect with some really incredibly talented musicians in our community. One of the things that we host at the Arts Council of Wayne County every month is the PNC Presents Wayne County Jazz Showcase. And that's a great event that people can come to and meet a lot of musicians that are living that have been documented for the trail.
One of the more popular musicians that people may not think of when they think of North Carolina is a jazz pianist Thelonious Monk from Rocky Mount. Sarah, who are some of the other musicians that some people might recognize but they didn't think had North Carolina roots that are on the trail?
Oh, wow. There is a lot of people, and especially, well, across North Carolina, actually, would probably be familiar with the Monitors. Their lead musician, Bill Myers, is really kind of the person that planted the seeds for the African American Music Trail. People will recognize the name Roberta Flack, and she was one of the first female vocalists for the Monitors. Out of Kinston, I would say Maceo Parker is very well known, and people would recognize him from the eastern part of the state. And he and his brother Melvin Parker are really instrumental in, I would say, shaping the sound of funk in America. And what's interesting about that is funk is really funk music, and that funk sound has really made a resurgence in the last few years. A lot of younger musicians are really starting to play a lot more with that genre.
On June 26th, the Arts Council of Wayne County will be presenting the Youth of the American Music Heritage Trail Concert. Can you tell me about some of the performances you have planned?
Yes. So we will have a performance by a Drummers World Drumline, and that is a group of young drummers. They're all still in middle school and high school. And that group is led by Orlando Mitchell, who is one of the original musicians that we documented for Wayne County for the African American Music Trail. He's a phenomenal drummer. He has created this wonderful program that works with children. So they'll be playing first, and then we'll have the Eric Xavier Quintet featuring Brian Miller, very well-known saxophone player. And Eric has made a name for himself. He is a younger saxophonist, jazz saxophonist out of Kinston. And then we will have a performance of Majesty Rose. And she, many people will recognize that name. She was in the top 10 of the last American Idol. So it's going to be a wonderful event. It's from 6:30 to 8:30 at Herman Park Gazebo in downtown Goldsboro. It's free, and we just ask people bring their lawn chairs and blankets and just be ready to have a really great evening of celebrating the African-American music traditions and how our young people are taking them on and passing them on and keeping them alive for future generations.
Sarah, of course, you're the Executive Director of the Arts Council of Wayne County. Thanks for speaking with me.
Thank you.
If you'd like more information about the Youth of the African-American Music Heritage Trails Concert, go to the events calendar, publicradioeast.org. For Public Radio East, I'm Mac McKay.
You're listening to the Downeast Journal on Public Radio East. Business underwriters on PRE are an important part of the Public Radio East funding family. 29% of our annual funding comes from their support. Please join us in thanking them for their help in keeping public radio viable in Eastern North Carolina.
Hi, this is Ken Meads, the Softer Sounds of Jazz Man. Softer Sounds is different from any jazz program you ever heard before, because you'll know all the tunes. You don't need to be a card-carrying jazz fan to enjoy this program. You just have to enjoy the best popular music ever written. Softer Sounds of Jazz is Saturday nights at 8 o'clock over PRE, Public Radio East, 89.3.
As the end of our fiscal year approaches, we would like to thank you for your financial support throughout the year. Your gifts have helped make sure that the ideals and mission of Public Radio East thrive in Eastern North Carolina. Your additional gift now before June 30th, above and beyond your annual membership, will help Public Radio East maintain financial stability. It is only with your help that PRE remains the most important news and entertainment service available in the region. Please add PRE to your list of financial priorities by sending your tax-deductible gift by June 30th. Mail your donations to Public Radio East, 800 College Court, New Bern, North Carolina, 28562, or call 1-800-222-9832 to charge your donation on Visa or MasterCard. You can also make a secure online pledge at publicradioeast.org. Thank you.
This is Lisa Rayburn, Horticulture Agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of The Garden Journal. I planted some Asiatic lilies last year, and they're in bloom, and man, are they gorgeous. Unfortunately, these flowers don't last forever. After 2 or maybe 3 weeks of blooms, the blossoms are gone, and I'm left with the foliage, which, depending on the plant, will stay green for weeks or months before naturally dying back. Clients often ask me what to do with the foliage of spent bulbs, and it really depends on the time of year. First, it's important to realize that plants that grow from bulbs, like daffodils and lilies, need their foliage after they bloom. It's actually this period after bloom when the plant is photosynthesizing and storing energy for next year's growth. It's also when the plant is setting the buds for next year's flowers. If you cut the foliage prematurely, next year's growth will not be as robust, and you may miss out on flowers altogether. So you'll want to let the foliage die back naturally before you cut it and remove it from the garden. Unfortunately, bulb foliage can be rather unattractive during this time, and there are several tricks that you can consider to help your garden look a little tidier. One of the things that I like to do is plant early spring bulbs, like daffodils and narcissus, among daylilies, which, by the way, daylilies grow from fleshy roots rather than bulbs. The vigorous growth of the daylilies actually camouflages the spent foliage of the daffodils and the narcissus. Any vigorous growing perennial that emerges early in the spring will do the trick, but daylilies are one of my favorites. The bulbs that mature later in the season, like the Asiatic lilies, are a little trickier. Instead of trying to camouflage them altogether, try planting later blooming perennials, such as salvia or asters, to help provide a pop of color and a visual diversion that pulls the visitor's eye away from the spent bulb foliage. We're lucky that here in the coastal plain, we have several bulbs that not only bloom, but actually their foliage adds a benefit or an interest to the garden. Tropical spider lily and crinum lily grow well in our area. They bloom later in the summer, and their foliage adds a tropical flair to the garden, holding up all through the season and only dying back in the fall. If you want to go out and help your bulbs along, then do go ahead and deadhead them after they bloom. By removing the spent flower blossoms, you're not only tidying up the plant, but also helping to prevent it from putting its precious energy into maturing seeds. This energy is instead sent to the roots, where it will power next year's growth. So limit your cutting to the spent flower blossoms, but allow the foliage to stay. Once it's died all the way back and yellowed, then you can remove it and add it to your compost pile. But be patient. That foliage is powering next year's growth.
This is the Down East Journal. The numbers prove that Americans love or disdain their pets. For those who love their pets, no number is too large, according to commentator Joan Karras.
Our country is apparently stuffed with pets, or companion animals, as they prefer to be called. According to the American Humane Society, the U.S. now is home to over 86 million cats, a tad more than 78 million dogs, and an unknown number of gerbils and white mice. You can tell by the number of mice working in scientific labs that they are probably smarter than the gerbils. Every year, 5 to 7 million dogs, cats, ferrets, and other unwanted critters enter animal shelters, where 3 to 4 million of them are eventually euthanized. The word euthanized comes from Greek roots, meaning good death, although I doubt that the animals would agree with that definition. For sure, life brought no joy for those unfortunate ones, les misérables. Still, most of us strive to provide joyful, healthy lives for our animal friends. The dogs, always delighted to see us, and the cats, presumably pleased that the staff remains on duty. I can't guess at the amount of equipment you own for your pets, but at last count, we had the following for our two enormous pussycats. 6 litter boxes, 4 grooming tools, one of them termed the Ferminator, 22 small balls of various sizes and musical ability, 6 fake birds badly mutilated, 11 well-chewed catnip mice, 5 wands with tantalizing feathery blobs that dance at the end of their elastic bands, a scratching post, unused, 4 food bowls, 2 water bowls, plus an outdoor water basin for drinking and washing paws, and an old sheet for hiding under to play games. A respectable collection, but certainly not record-breaking. Sleeping arrangements for pets fascinate me. One couple we know shares their double bed with 2 dogs and 4 cats. On nights with scary storms, they add 2 children to the mix. A friend of ours says that her cat sleeps on her face. I was aching to ask how she could breathe, but I stifled myself. Yet another friend says her cat wraps himself around her neck and sleeps that way all night. All night. In the summer? I squeaked, knowing how warm cats are. But she nodded happily, so I shut up. Blessed are the animals who find these good homes. They dine on sautéed chicken livers and scrambled eggs. The gerbils have exercise balls which they can pilot across the floor to ensure their fitness. We wouldn't want a corpulent gerbil, heaven forfend. Companion mice are offered mazes for keeping fit and developing their minds. Wee little dogs have wardrobes for inclement weather, and large dogs have beds that would comfort any sleeper. All of these pets have excellent, free medical care. Well, free for the pets. Mom and Dad may grumble, but they'll pay. Why? Because pets bring us joy and laughter. Because they are our companions. Often they know us better than our relatives do, and they love us anyway.
Joan Karas is a children's book author who lives in Beaufort. Her latest book is Magic at the Bed and Biscuit, published by Candlewick Press. Thanks for listening to the Down East Journal. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features, you can drop us a line at publicradioeast.org. Have a great weekend.